What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Feels so great to say that. Michael, I wish I had better news for you off the top today. Unfortunately, the NBA's woes with the coronavirus are escalating here over the last couple of days. We've got plenty of basketball to discuss, I think, including doing a deep dive on maybe some of the excitement around the Golden State Warriors and some of my concerns about the Los Angeles Clippers as they try to position themselves in the Western Conference chase of the Los Angeles Lakers. But I do think that we need to start here, Michael, with basically three games being postponed over the last 24 hours. You saw one game on Sunday involving the Boston Celtics and the Miami Heat being postponed because the Heat were caught up in a significant contact tracing situation. You saw two more games on Monday morning be postponed, one involving the Boston Celtics, who themselves were caught up in massive contact tracing, and another involving the Dallas Mavericks, who had multiple positive tests here and had a number of players sidelined in recent days for the same reason. We've also seen some pretty high-profile players either test positive or be put into contact tracing because of the league's protocols, whether that was Kevin Durant a week or two ago, whether that was Jason Tatum of the Boston Celtics over the last few days. And then because of an on-court exchange between Jason Tatum and Bradley Beal, close friends and St. Louis natives, after a game last week, Bradley Beal found himself put into basically isolation temporarily because he was caught on video, you know, hugging and embracing Jason Tatum, who, of course, tested positive. So the NBA is getting a full dose of some of the nightmare scenarios I think that we had realized could be possible before the start of the season. And I think a big question that circulated over the weekend was, would the NBA want to push pause, and should they try to push pause here and allow everything to kind of simmer down and, you know, go forward with your normal schedule? Michael, did you think it was coming to that point over the weekend? To me, that talk felt slightly premature, although I'm very uncomfortable with, you know, the quantity and the sheer number of players and teams that are caught up in this thing right now. It just didn't seem like it had turned that to that breaking point quite yet. What'd you think?
Yeah, I agree with you, Ben. And the way I look at it is that the league has decided to play NBA games during a pandemic. So when you're doing that and you don't have a bubble and you know that there are going to be players who test positive at mass, that, you know, two games being postponed, three games being postponed, that's just not going to cut it. Like, they didn't release a schedule for the back half of this season for this very reason. All of this was anticipated, I think, by the NBA and the league office. So, like, none of this should really be a surprise to people who are, like, shocked that games are being, not shocked, but, like, jarred by games being postponed. Cases are raging throughout the country. This is what it is when you decide to play, and this is the door that the NBA has walked through. So I do think that if this maintains through February, like if the league looks today as it looks a month from now as it does today, where cases are just kind of like ravaging different teams, long after holiday travels and, you know, if the vaccine rollout continues to be bungled in a huge metropolitan areas, then I think that the league may need to reassess what is going on here. But at the same time, like, a fair argument can be made that this is for the best health-wise for players who would otherwise be living on their own outside of such a structured environment with their teams without access to testing. So I think it's like a pretty complicated issue. But to have a couple games get postponed with players who are out, not because they tested positive necessarily, but because of contact tracing measures, it's just not going to cut it so far.
Yes, I think that if you're seeing situations where a team reports, like, say, one positive test, right, but then they're not able to take the court because of contact tracing, in my opinion, I almost view that as a good situation, relatively speaking anyways, because at least you know that they're being cautious with the contact tracing. And I think that there has been a certain level of, I don't know if you want to call it lack of transparency or confusion about exactly, you know, who gets caught up in the contact tracing, what's the standard. So if Bradley Beal talks to Jason Tatum on the court after the game in close contact, he has to go to isolation and kind of test negative, right? But if people guard Jason Tatum in that game and they're not in that extended, you know, kind of close proximity, you know, face to face, hugging him and embracing him and all those things, they don't have to be put into the contact tracing program. I think that that, you know, makes people uncomfortable because you don't know exactly what the standard would be. And I'm not sure the NBA has been completely forthcoming and transparent on those types of issues. And of course, every single one of those things is going to be open to interpretation. And they're doing this essentially for the first time this season. And so that, you know, also makes you uncomfortable. Of course, what everyone was trying to avoid is the outbreak and the team-to-team spread during games. This is something that you and I talked about all the way back before the bubble even took place, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of basketball being an indoor sport, played in close contact, you know, being in a situation where, you know, say Rudy Gobert tests positive, and then next thing you know, you've got Donovan Mitchell positive, and you've got an opponent in Christian Wood also positive, and that kind of thing running rampant throughout teams. So that's what we're trying to avoid. So if games get postponed because of contact tracing, rather than seven guys testing positive, I view that you know, as a minor win in the grand scheme of things. Of course, you're just trying to, you know, keep those numbers down as much as you can. If that means postponements, so be it. I do want to read you a quote, though, Michael, from Adam Silver back in December when people asked him before the season started, hey, what's the standard here for a pushing pause or shutting down? I mean, what exactly is it going to take? And he said, if we found a situation where our protocols weren't working, meaning that not only did we have some cases of COVID, but that we were witnessing spread either among teams or even possibly to another team, that would cause us to suspend the season. I think we are prepared for isolated cases. In fact, based on what we've seen in the preseason, based on watching other leagues operating outside the bubble, unfortunately, it seems somewhat inevitable, but we're prepared for all contingencies. And I think a more recent statement by Adam Silver coming from a piece by Shams Charania of The Athletic, basically Adam Silver told a group, including some of the NBPA's leadership, that January was going to be the NBA's worst month, he believed, and he was optimistic about improvements in February. So this is the standard the NBA is working with. Would you agree that so far the NBA, even with these three postponements, hasn't reached the standard that Adam Silver set? In other words, they're not moving the goalposts yet, are they?
I don't think so, no. And I mean, I guess like when I'm just watching all of this unfold from afar, my takeaway is that the contact tracing measures are like, I mean, they're pretty arbitrary. Is that fair to say, Ben? Like, I know that the Philadelphia 76ers had a game where basically everybody was out after Seth Curry tested positive. But I'm just, I just don't understand why that game was played at all. If, like, I assume there were players on that team who were in the locker room with, who played in that game, who were in the locker room with Seth Curry. You know, there were, the Philadelphia 76ers played a game the night before against the Washington Wizards, and the Wizards continued to play. So, like, a lot of this just feels, like, I know that they're testing twice a day on game days, but a lot of it feels just really, not random, definitely, but just, like, case by case when I feel like there should be harder rules in place. Does that make any sense at all?
It does. I mean, the Boston Globe had an interesting report that I hadn't seen previously, essentially saying that the NBA's position is that if you're just playing basketball over the course of a normal game, even though players guard each other in close proximity, they don't spend enough consistent time and total time mm-hmm. to make it likely that the virus is spread. Now, this is not even an argument the NBA used or hinted at, you know, during the bubble or at any other point. So again, this was kind of new information to me. But then you do see, as I mentioned, where guys are having a conversation after a game for, say, you know, 3 minutes on the court, you know, if that, and that winds up putting a Bradley Beal into contact tracing. So I'm not sure if arbitrary is the right word, but I go back to the idea of lack of transparency. The NBA has not just sort of laid out exactly what gets you into contact tracing, what's okay, what's not okay. And like I said, I do think that they're kind of applying it on a case-by-case basis. They're trying to do it in real time, and they're also doing this for the first time for the league. So that's going to lead to situations that leave outsiders confused. It sort of boils down to, in my opinion, whether the players trust the league's contact tracing program, right? Or how they're monitoring this thing. Now, it seemed like the Philadelphia 76ers had real reservations about taking the court, right? And not that the NBA like forced them to take the court, but it did kind of boil down to, look, we know you guys have seven available players, and you know you're being forced to say that Mike Scott, even though he's coming off an injury, is available, and you've got some of your star guys, you know, sitting out for minor injuries that they hadn't kept them sidelined previously. So you kind of wonder, okay, what exactly is going on here in terms of their desire to play, right? Or the organization's desire to put its best players on the court. You know, in that kind of a situation, you could easily understand, and I'm not saying they did this, but if I was the owner, if I was the GM, or I was the coach, and I had a player test positive, and, you know, we weren't completely sure that the spread was, you know, contained to just that one player, I might want to just keep my best players in isolation regardless of what the NBA's rules were until I was completely convinced everybody else was okay. There's obviously major investments in the health of these star players, and so that should be almost treated with an extra degree of care. You could see that argument being made, and it just felt like putting the Sixers out there for a game, they weren't really comfortable playing, as Doc Rivers said that prior to that game. And you know, you're looking at the ragtag roster they put on the court. That's not really in anybody's best interest. But I guess on the flip side, it's not like they have to refund the fans' ticket prices. You know, there's nobody in the game. They're just sort of going through the motions, checking the box to say, hey, this game has taken place. And I think ultimately, like, they're still arguing some games are better than no games, right? And games with half teams are better than games with nobody. And so we just kind of play through regardless of the reservations. And, you know, that could get to a pretty, you know, tough to swallow place here if the virus isn't contained over the next week or two. I mean, we could be seeing situations like that Philly situation on a regular basis. And I think, you know, for the fans or for media analysts, I think our only response is to say, sorry, guys, these results don't really count. It doesn't matter if Denver beats Philly, you know, with half their roster out. We can't really say that's a legitimate result. And so that's a real risk the NBA is incurring here, is undercutting the validity of these games because, you know, their situation isn't able to put full teams on the court. But I don't know if they have any alternative or any end around from that. I mean, they may just be stuck, forced to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's obvious competitive disadvantages in play, and that is maybe the least important thing that we're discussing in this conversation, in this context. But, like, one of the things that just looking over the safety protocols from the league that has been going on that was in that article by Shams is that when players are on the road in hotel rooms, they're allowed up to two guests, and that could be, as Shams writes, family members or longtime close personal friends who reside in the city where the team is staying. And upon reading that, I was like, why is this allowed? This makes absolutely zero sense to me. So as you know, as we're recording this, there have been reports that the NBA and the NBPA are going to be discussing changes to the protocols, because stuff like this just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. Obviously, there's like a mental health component to, you know, isolating in your hotel room every time you're on the road versus being able to, you know, have people who have human interaction, I guess is the most fundamental way to put it. But it's all very strange from this off the court, these rules to, you know, watching Tyrese Maxey go off for 39 points and like celebrating it. It's just like, I don't even know what, like, if you're trying to put out this product as an NBA, as the NBA, like, what is even the point? Because as you said, it really, the results are not legitimate, right?
Yeah, well, I think the point is, you know, television money. People are watching. There have been some amazing games. It's one of these situations, again, where we're just being forced to compartmentalize at the same moment where we're having these games ruined. We're also having some spectacular individual performances from guys like Steph Curry and Kawhi Leonard over the weekend. And you can go right down the list to Jokic and Doncic last week. And, you know, I'm sure people saw LeBron's left-handed full-court pass the other night. I mean, it's not completely ruined, but it's definitely damaged. And my concern is that it could get significantly more damaged if these trends continue, because it's certainly accelerating here over the last week in a noticeable way. Now, in terms of some of the things that the NBA could do here to tighten up, I think that's an important question, because the NBA said in a release on Monday it was going to meet with the Players Association about how they could, you know, try to get you know, some adjustments to the health and safety protocols, and they kind of left it at that. You know, talking to experts prior to the season in terms of what they were worried about. There was the road component that you're describing. There is a situation where in some states restaurants are open, so if you're able to kind of like go and be in public and get yourself into higher risk situations than in other states, that could expose you in some way. There's also this idea that when you're at home, you're able to have meals, say, with other teams or your friends around the league. That could be a situation of higher risk. And there's also guys who just flat out have kids, and families, where they're going about their daily lives. When they come home from a road trip, they see them, and they could be exposed that way as well. It's hard to tighten up a lot of that stuff. I mean, the family stuff, you really can't tighten up that much more. I think the overnight guest thing that you're describing on the road trip, that's going to be a thorny issue for players, because that's what upset them. One of the things that really got to them about the bubble was this idea of, physical isolation from loved ones and romantic interests. And that's like one of those last deal breakers. But, I think the NBA could be in a situation here where it's like, we need to really crack down for the next couple of weeks to get this thing back under control, and then hopefully we can go forward, into the All-Star break. I mean, that may be their stance. It's like, hey, we've got to, put in some new rules, and they have done that actually over the last couple of weeks. I'm sure you saw that the players are wearing those same Connexin proximity alarms that I had to wear during the bubble, where basically it beeps if you stay in close contact with other people inside of 6 feet when you're, basically not playing games. Those things are super annoying. They feel like dog collars, but they do give the NBA the ability to kind of track player location, and it helps with the contact tracing because they can go back and say, hey, yeah, this guy was, having dinner with a player who tested positive. He absolutely has to be, shut down in quarantine because those guys were sitting across the table for 45 minutes. That's a valuable tool for the NBA. They've also increased the whole mask wearing thing. Like, before you check into games, if you're on the bench, you're supposed to be wearing masks. I could see that becoming an even bigger part of the deal. And I think they should be cracking down on the coaches with the masks too. I mean, these guys are taking them off their mouth and noses constantly during games as they're trying to coach. Like, if that's part of your protocol, mm-hmm. And I think that Doc Rivers actually got dinged on that one. If that's part of your protocol, I mean, I would be enforcing and letting teams know that this is a tough situation. Every postponed game hurts the league. So, you've got to enforce the rules that you made. I mean, they certainly enforced rules tightly in the bubble, whether it was Daniel House, being evicted from the Grand Floridian Hotel or some of the other, just nuisance text messages that guys like me were dealing with constantly, telling us, hey, you can do this, you can't do that, you can't eat dinner at the arena and so forth. I think that, it might be time for the NBA to go that route as well.
Yeah, I talked to a player for a story that really had nothing to do with COVID, and he told me that he declined to go. His team was in Houston recently, and he declined to attend a team dinner that was at a restaurant for basically wanting to be as safe as possible. And what strikes me as really just complicated about that is, even if this player decides not to go, his teammates are, and if one of his teammates contracts COVID, then he is at risk. It's just such a messy situation. Going back to what you said earlier, though, about the fact that there are still really entertaining games, I agree with that for sure. But I also just wonder, what is the point if we get to the stage where stars are, Bradley Beal, Jason Tatum, there have already been stars who have
Kevin Durant
forced. Yeah, Kevin Durant, yes, 100%.
Michael Porter Jr. I mean, there's been a lot of guys implicated here. I think if you're the NBA, are you getting towards this idea of like, well, does the season even count? Are people going to view it as an asterisk? Are you headed that direction? Because I think ultimately, if they can stumble into the playoffs and then, and then hopefully have fewer issues in the playoffs, isn't that what it's going to take to have people kind of validate this season? I do think in my mind, though, I came in viewing this season as being completely different and, struggling with credibility issues even more so than the bubble, And we talked about that asterisk a lot heading into the bubble, but when you're looking at shortening the number of games this season, condensing it, having a completely, short turnaround for certain teams and variable off-season lengths for everybody, condensed preseason, no fans in the arena. I mean, this is a challenging year, and maybe we all just have to acknowledge that it's going to be viewed differently by history.
Yeah, I mean, just as we're talking right now, it really hits home how valuable, I mean, the vaccine is valuable to everyone. It's valuable to the world and society and humanity. But strictly speaking about the NBA in this context, like, the vaccine is basically everything, because in the spring when the postseason begins, like, I really have a difficult time seeing teams accept their best players not being able to play because of contact tracing measures. Like, I really don't, I can't even envision it, honestly. Like, I just think that right now what we're seeing is really a devalue of regular season basketball in a sense. And I'm very curious to see just how this sort of evolves as the season progresses. And I think that, you know, I think Adam Silver is probably correct in that January is terrible for reasons that have to do with holiday travel, and that in February and March and April, hopefully things go down a little bit and you know, people, I have like no faith in our country to turn this around, but like, you know, hopefully people take things as seriously as possible and people around the country take the vaccine and the vaccine is accessible to them. But yeah, it's just, I guess I just go back to, like, I have a really hard time seeing the same rules being applied right now being applied in the postseason. I just don't even think they would have games at all.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, look, they still have the backup plan, which could be doing a bubble for the playoffs or some portion of the playoffs. I think that I would be in favor of that if I were them, because if you have one star player, any of the guys who we mentioned, Beal, Tatum, KD, out for contact tracing or a positive test in a playoff series, the whole thing goes up, right? And you've kind of, you know, given up the entire point of, you know, the 6 month buildup into that matchup and getting guys on the court and all the analysis that's been taking place. And it just feels random if you don't have better protection. So for me, that's what I would do if I were in their situation. Maybe it's the last three rounds of the playoffs, so it's not quite as much time. Maybe it's just the playoffs. You know, however you want to negotiate that out with the players in terms of how much time can you fit in a bubble, unless they can get vaccines to basically everyone in the league, that's how I would handle it. As we're talking here, the final note on this topic, Michael, as we're talking, Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN.com reports, these are the topics that they're going to talk about between the league and the Players Association that we were mentioning earlier. We pretty much guessed what they were going to be. It is pre- and post-game socializing on the court, you know, which is what kind of got Bradley Beal and Jason Tatum. Further restrictions on restaurant dining, which we talked about, especially on road trips. And then tighter rules on mask wearing, which is what I was mentioning with guys on the bench and coaches maybe needing to be even more diligent about using them. He also said that examining shoot-arounds and practice lengths could be an issue that they discuss as well. So I guess the thought there would be, if you cut out shoot-arounds or you cut down practices, you just have fewer possible exposures from teammate to teammate and within a team, right? And that makes some sense too. Maybe just only play games, Michael. Just show up only, you know, 50 times the rest of the season and everybody will be fine. Who knows?
That elevates the quality of the product for sure. And it's just like, it's so funny. Yeah.
Well, look, despite everything that we just said, there has been some really entertaining games recently. One of them that caught my attention was Friday between the Warriors and the Clippers. And the Clippers, to me right now, it's like the ultimate case. You can make really strong arguments. It's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or the glass is half full, the glass is half empty, right? Because the Clippers have this incredible starting lineup with this massive efficiency differential that's positive when those guys are on the court. Nicholas Batum, a guy who I absolutely thought was completely cooked and you predicted was going to be an impact player for them, has come right in and been a major impact player. Serge Ibaka has kind of stepped in and acclimated fairly well for the Clippers. They build this gigantic lead against Golden State. Everything is rolling. Paul George has been absolutely red hot to start the season, shooting something like 51% on three-pointers, right? They get into that second half, and absolutely everything falls off, and all the ghosts of those playoff collapses from the bubble come back to haunt them. They can't stop everybody. Eric Pascal is just absolutely destroying Ivica Zubac. I mean, the Warriors bench, which, you know, I've been kind of talking down on for the last 3 or 4 weeks, just destroys the Clippers bench. And now all of a sudden everything, you know, feels like it's it's, you know, a complete mess for the Clippers. And Kawhi Leonard, once again, down the stretch, really having no impact, turnovers, brick jumpers. I mean, it's sort of like the worst case scenario for the Clippers. And so, you know, kind of coming out of that game, we actually got a number of emails, which I appreciated. And they emailed us openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. All right. Salon writes, after another sublime performance from Steph Curry, who I believe had 9 3-pointers in that game, Michael. Michael deserves to take an extended victory lap on the show next week. The Warriors are once again the most entertaining team in the league. Steph Curry is an MVP leader, and Andrew Wiggins has actually had some moments. So, Michael, this email made me chuckle because the previous night, the team that I had put up in this conversation, the Dallas Mavericks, played an awesome game that went into overtime against the Denver Nuggets. And so I don't know if I want to give you the victory lap. What do you think? Are you ready to take it?
For those who can't see, which is everybody, including you, I'm standing up over my laptop taking a bow right now. I think I nailed this one in dramatic fashion, honestly. I knew that the Golden State Warriors were going to be, I didn't know anything, but I had a feeling they were going to be very entertaining. I had a feeling that Steph was going to play great basketball. Was waiting for Draymond to get back. Draymond gets back, and they look like a completely different basketball team. And Steph is looking like vintage Steph. So, yes, you may stand and applaud, Ben. You may.
I don't know. Luka was so good in overtime the previous night. I'm not going to concede it completely. But the thing about Steph, I'll say this, and even compared to Luka, I do think you've got a point. He moves people's hearts in a way that basically no one else in the NBA does. Even LeBron. You know, I think that people, I saw so many tweets, not only during that game against the Clippers, but also during a 62-point performance where people were saying, God, it's been a long time since I felt joy, right? Or this game has got me happier than I can remember in weeks and months. And Steph Curry just has that aspect to his game when he gets into those side shimmy three-pointers, step backs, draining in people's faces, running around the court with three defenders chasing him and all that stuff. It's just a different visual experience, a different aesthetic experience. And, you know, when he's dancing after he hits a shot, you want to dance after he hits a shot. And it's been a long time coming. We've missed that. It's not been there necessarily every single night. I mean, the Warriors, to me, have still been kind of an inconsistent team from a night-to-night basis. But Steph Curry has been, you know, at a very, very high level early to start the season, as you mentioned, and he's got them above 500. Now, in that Clippers game, I want to ask you, did he rob the Clippers' heart late in that game? Because we've actually seen that with previous iterations of the Clippers, you know, the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin Clippers, where when Steph Curry goes off, he just breaks them completely, you know, and down the stretch of games, you know, he puts them away with blowout wins. It felt like a little bit of deja vu with this group, even though he never really went against Kawhi and Paul George last year because of health reasons. But, you know, was it the same story? It was the same old Clippers just getting torched by Steph Curry and nothing they could do about it? Or did you see something else going on from the Clippers side?
Maybe a little bit of that for sure. I mean, he had a tremendous game. He, you know, he demanded or commanded a Kawhi Leonard assignment, which is always just like the utmost sign of respect. And Kawhi, I feel like Kawhi did an okay job. He didn't put the clamps on Steph because nobody who has ever lived can put the clamps on Steph in single coverage. But, you know, when I was watching that game, particularly the fourth quarter, like my big takeaways were mostly just that, like, you know, the Clippers offense is, it's just really interesting, particularly like when they need to get a basket, how they play. I mean, they were trying to hunt Steph Curry on the defensive end. They were having his man set ball screens for Kawhi over and over again and just not getting the looks that they wanted. There were a couple of times where, you know, they forced the switch and then Kawhi was able to find like Batum in the corner or Kennard on the wing, and those guys were able to do a little bit of damage. But for the most part, their offense just wasn't clicking as it did in the first half. And Paul George, who, as you said, has been just like an inferno this entire season. His numbers are like 50-50-90 shooting. It's a ridiculous start for him. Good for him coming off the postseason that he had. But he basically just like didn't touch the basketball down the stretch of that game either, which I thought was pretty interesting. But like when I look at this Clippers team, you know, I'm talking about their offense. Their offense is, I think, second best in the entire NBA. And when Kawhi and Paul George are on the floor, they're unstoppable normally. The defense is really where it's getting pretty interesting. I think they rank 25th right now, something way up there after having a really impressive defense last season. And they obviously have Kawhi. They obviously have PG. They have Patrick Beverley. They have some pretty good defenders on their team. But, like, the way that they just – like, the defensive mistakes that they made, particularly on the three-point line with some of Golden State's three-point shooters, because, like, Golden State right now has some shooters. Like, Damian Lee is hitting 47% beyond the arc. Michael Mulder's hitting his threes. Even Kent Bazemore is hitting some, and you know Kelly Oubre is still in just this ridiculous slump. But the defensive mistakes that they made, miscommunication errors. There was one play where Luke Kennard just decided not to switch off of Draymond Green, and he let Bazemore just wide open for you know he could tie his shoes before he took the shot, and Serge Ibaka was like screaming at Kennard. And these are the types of plays where yeah, it's a little bit concerning right now. But the way I see it is this is the regular season. This is what the regular season is for. You work out the kinks. A lot of these pieces are new. And, you know, when it comes time to the playoffs, hopefully we get there. Like, I think that things will turn around for them on that end. But to see it on display in that game in particular, against a Warriors team that, as you said, has struggled, I think, for the most part this season, and isn't like a top elite upper tier offense. Like it was just a little jarring to see, I guess.
Yeah, so they've got a number of things going on that I kind of want to point out, maybe differences from like this year to last year. So as you mentioned, they've got multiple new starters, and they've got almost a completely overhauled bench when you're looking at who's actually getting minutes. I mean, Montrezl Harrell leaving, Luke Kennard coming in. You know, Marcus Morris being in a different role to start the season at least. And then in the starting lineup, you've got Batum and Ibaka. So their offense, especially when their starters are playing together, is excellent. And actually their starting defense by the numbers is excellent. What happens is for years, their bench has been one of the league's highest scoring and therefore best differentials. Like they win a lot of minutes when their bench has been on the court, and it's been completely the opposite this year. Their bench defense cannot guard anyone. You saw it against the Warriors, where that's when they gave up the huge lead. You know, to all these you know bench guys just getting absolutely picked apart. You know, Zubac being in a bench role, I think, is actually tougher for him because he's a traditional center. A lot of teams go smaller with their second units, and so he gets himself into more matchup issues against smaller and more versatile players. That's kind of been an issue. And then I also just think they really miss Montrezl Harrell's offense and energy. Lou Williams' numbers have been really down this year. He's not scoring as much. He's also not playing as much. And their bench scoring has completely fallen off a cliff if you look at the rankings. And their bench defense is just abominable, right? So I think if you're trying to spin this positively for the Clippers, you say, well, look, they're probably going to tighten things up more when they get to the playoffs, not in, play the bench quite as much. They're going to expect that veteran guys who are probably working themselves into the season this year are going to play at a higher level and make fewer of the mistakes that you're kind of describing. And you're going to lean on your best players, if at all possible. And they've got a lot of versatility. They've got a lot of intelligence. And they've got a lot of experience in those spots, especially with their starting lineup with that group. But the other thing I'm seeing, Michael, is the trends that drove me crazy in last year's bubble are getting worse. And down the stretch of that game, they're talking about how they're struggling to create good shots. And I think a big part of the problem is because Kawhi Leonard's getting the free throw line less, Paul George is getting the free throw line less, and Kawhi Leonard is getting to the basket way less. And Paul George is basically not getting to the basket. So far this season, 9% of his field goal attempts are coming in the basket area, right? If you look at the Clippers as a team, they're the worst in the league at generating baskets around the basket area, you know, in terms of being able to put pressure on the rim, get to the basket. You've got Kawhi, who's a jump shooter, Paul George, who's a jump shooter. You've got Serge Ibaka, who is a spot-up shooter in place of Montrezl Harrell, who obviously attacked the rim a lot. You've got Lou Williams, who does a lot of his, you know, work on the perimeter. Nicholas Batum's a spot-up shooter, so it's not necessarily a surprise. Some of it is by design because they want to be a, you know, really high-powered three-point shooting team. But I guess my question is, it's the same as it was during the bubble. If you're not really getting the free throw line consistently in volume, if your two best players are relying so heavily on mid-range jumpers and three-pointers, you're going to be exposed to bigger swings of momentum. You're going to have a harder time just kind of putting your foot down when a team like Golden State makes a big run like they did on Friday night, and it's going to be harder for you to counterpunch. So, you know, on Sunday, they turn back around. Kawhi shoots the ball great. He hits like 7 3-pointers, and they win in dramatic fashion. But my question is, do they have the kind of sustainable components in their offense in terms of how they're generating points that they're going to be able to overcome the Lakers? And that's actually a key strength for the Lakers. LeBron gets a lot of points around the basket. Anthony Davis gets a lot of points around the basket. Both those guys get to the free throw line consistently. And so I think that's, to me, it's kind of a sign of regression. I look at the Clippers compared to last year, and I say their bench is worse. Their overall defense is worse, which is a concern. But, you know, as we've said, they could turn that around. But their shot selection has gotten worse rather than better. And I'm wondering, is it by design? Is Kawhi just reluctant to attack the hoop because of where his body's at physically? Is Paul George saving himself for the playoffs? And we just didn't see those guys turn the switch during last year's playoffs and get more aggressive when they needed to. And my concern is maybe that switch is no longer there to turn. Is that overreacting?
I think it might be. I mean, my overarching question to your assessment is, I mean, you kind of just covered it, but do you think Kawhi Leonard cannot get to the rim and draw fouls, or do you think that he does not want to? That's the big question that we need to really unpack here. And for
for me, real quick on that, he didn't when he needed to against Denver. I assumed that he could heading into the last year's playoffs. I assumed he was just sort of like load managing his playing style and he would kind of crank it up, right? But even you go back to that 2019 finals run, he wasn't always in great condition physically just because of the injury. It wasn't like he was out of shape. It was just that when he needed to like kind of really exert himself, there was moments where he was kind of limping around the court. He looked uncomfortable, and he was able to get through and get by in pretty admirable fashion in 2019, but there were some warning signs. I was expecting him to turn it up in the 2020 playoffs, and he didn't. I mean, he did at times, but not consistently, especially late in games and especially late in series. And you're coming this year, and you're seeing it kind of go back the other way. It makes me nervous, and I would just like to see it more, especially in a game like that Friday night game where everyone's looking around for Kawhi to save the day, right? It's his team. It's been his team. The whole thing was kind of built around him. Steph is going absolutely nuts. You're supposed to kind of rise to that occasion. And he's clanking 15-foot jumpers and getting locked up by Draymond on the three-point line and not even getting himself within 10 feet of the basket, let alone some free throws. That's concerning. If I was one of his teammates, I would be like, wait a minute, what's happening here? You know, and I actually give Paul George a lot of credit for stepping forward as an offensive threat this year and exerting himself more. He's been in a really nice groove, and he hasn't been deferring as much as I think he did at times last year. I think that should continue. But yeah, I am a little bit nervous at whether Kawhi can get to the rim like he used to.
So I want to give a little bit of credit to Kawhi. You know, watching the end of LA's narrow win against the Chicago Bulls over the weekend after their loss to the Warriors, Kawhi did have a really impressive, it was kind of like a floater in the restricted area. It was like a really nice shot. And when he came down, this was basically a nail in the coffin type of shot that basically sealed the deal. He came down and someone on the Bulls, I believe, kind of crashed into his leg. And for like a split second, he was on the ground holding his knee. And then he just kind of like popped up because he's Terminator and jogged down the court and wasn't even limping. So like when you see something like that, you're kind of just like, if you're a
you're
Clippers
saying
fan, I think. Or...
never attack the basket again, Kawhi. Just wait until May.
No.
Is that what?
Well, no. I just think that like the fact that he did and he was successful and he almost suffered a terrible injury is just like, I can't get too worked up about this. Like for me, Kawhi is who he is. I know there are things that we can watch and learn during the regular season, but when someone as great as him is struggling a little bit, like I tend to give him the benefit of the doubt. And like when I just look, when I zoom out and I look at his whole profile so far this season, like to use the word struggling is like an exaggeration, I think, because he's averaging 25, he's shooting 43% from the 3-point line, he's a career high assist rate. He's trying to figure things out with all these new teammates and new pieces. And he's also trying to find new shots in a different offensive system with a new head coach. One of the bigger concerns to me, though, is like the free throw rate is down, but also the 3-point rate is down, despite him shooting as accurately as he is. And I'm just like,
all the good shots are going away. That's what I'm saying. So here's my point here, just real quick. On the stuff at the basket, in 2019, 25% of his attempts came in the basket area. So he was putting his head down quite a bit for Toronto and getting to the rim. This year, it's at 15%. That's a career low. You go back and earlier in his career with San Antonio, when obviously he's much younger, more explosive, and he's also a role player, so he's doing more cutting. You know, consistently 30% of his baskets were coming from around the basket area. So if you take all those away and you reduce free throws and you reduce three-pointers and he's replacing it almost consistently or almost entirely rather with mid-range shots, he's just going to be a less effective, less efficient overall offensive weapon, right? That doesn't mean that he's bad, but I think that those changes could be the difference from him being the best player on a title team to being the best player on a really good team that's going to hit a wall in the playoffs. That's my concern. And the reason why I raise these questions is because these guys are the biggest threat to the Lakers right now, especially in the Western Conference. If you look from a matchup standpoint, who can deal with LeBron defensively? Who can deal with Anthony Davis defensively? I would rather have the Clippers group of Ibaka, Morris, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, you know, and Zubac. I would rather have that group on paper than any other team's defensive personnel, really in both conferences, honestly, right? But if their defensive numbers have not been up to par whatsoever, so that's concerning. But then they're also going to have to be able to score at an efficient clip, and LeBron and Anthony Davis are such outrageously efficient scorers, and they're playing with such great chemistry. It just concerns me if the Clippers' best weapon is not operating at peak levels. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, and I think that when I look at Kawhi and you know, he takes these 12-footers, 16-foot jumpers. He gets to his spots. And for me, it's just like when they don't fall, I'm just like, this is what you signed up for with Kawhi. Like, this is, he's one of the best in the, he's been one of the best in the league since he's entered his prime at this exact shot, getting to where he wants on the floor. That right baseline fadeaway is unguardable. And his signature move. And when he goes there, it's a real tough shot, not efficient, says analytics. When it comes out of his hand, it's fine. But this season, he's shooting 40% on long twos. That's not an elite number at all. And by comparison, if you go back to when he was with Toronto that one season, it was 46%. A couple years before that, when he was the runner-up for MVP, it was 48%. He's hit 49% at some spots in his career. So 40%, not good. I personally just look at it and I'm like, this will turn around. This will bump up a little bit. And I think I'm just generally less concerned about his aggression throughout a regular season that is just so strange and weird. And I think he's playing the most minutes of his career and hasn't really been, you know, I guess, load managing as much as maybe we suspected. So like for him to just be this guy throughout the regular season, I'm not, maybe it's just like my gut telling me that I need to have faith in him, but I can't get as worried about it.
You're never worried about Kawhi. And I would just say for all the ladies out there, find you a man who believes in you as much as Michael believes in Kawhi Leonard. It's just unbelievable. Just something to track, Michael. I don't want to write any of these teams off, and I also don't want to overanalyze the early returns too much because, as we've described, it's kind of a crazy and weird season. But just visually, you know, the numbers match some of the things that I was worried about with the Clippers. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we kind of need them to address some of these things. Hopefully they're seeing some of these same trends and kind of coming up with ways that they can work around it. And, you know, if Kawhi's just coasting, fine. You know, we'll check back in a couple months. But these are my early returns on the Clippers, who, like I said, I view as the biggest threat to the Lakers right now in the West. All right, let's shift gears here real quick. One of the teams you were trying to hype up a lot, Michael, and don't get too comfortable in your victory lap, was the Atlanta Hawks before the season started. Peter wants to know, how did Atlanta get so bad on offense after looking so good? I know that they started scoring something like 120 points per 100 possessions, but they have fallen off a cliff. Is it cold shooting, or has the NBA solved Trae Young's new tricks? And also, Michael, there was a report from The Athletic about internal turmoil between John Collins and Trae Young last week in terms of, you know, Collins wanting to have more role in the offense and maybe Trey was doing a little bit too much freelancing solo work, and Trey responded to that by essentially taking his ball and going home and not being a very active offensive player in their next game. I think he was probably clearly wounded, it seems like, from some of the comments that were made about his playing style. When you're trying to diagnose what ails Atlanta right now, who do you blame, or what's at fault? And then also, you know, whose side are you on? Team John Collins or Team Trae Young?
I don't really know who to blame for any of this. Like, you know, they start the season really hot, and I guess this is just like a warning to everyone that no one should overreact to a four-game sample size. You know, they lose two to the Charlotte Hornets, a team that is just going zone. They had no idea how to do anything with Charlotte's zone defense, which isn't a great sign. They have been injured, which is pretty important. I mean, Danilo Gallinari basically hasn't played this season. Rajon Rondo has been out. And Chris Dunn, who wasn't signed to help out on the offensive end, but has not made his debut with the Atlanta Hawks. And now we have Bogdan Bogdanovic, who had a really unfortunate knee injury, and we don't know when he's coming back. So, like, their physical health is not in a great place right now. And you know, if you just look at some of the numbers with Trey specifically through this most recent patch, like, he's 3-for-19 from beyond the arc in Atlanta's last four games and taking single-digit free throw attempts, which for him, that's just atrocious, and this offense, I don't think, can survive if he's doing that. As far as the Team Trey versus Team Collins thing, you know, I'm Team Peace and Harmony, personally, so I just want everybody to get along, but if I had to pick one side, you know, I think Collins has some good points about Trey's shot selection. It's really hard to deal with someone who goes off script as often as Trey does, and most of the time, the result is brilliance. But I just want you to put yourself in John Collins' shoes for 2 seconds. Like, imagine you're sprinting up from the baseline to set a screen for Trey. And when you're 3/4 of the way there, he just jacks up a three that slams off the back iron and leads to a fast break layup the other way. Like, how upset would you be by that? I would be very pissed.
I would be upset too, but not as upset as Trey Young surely was when John Collins, you know, missed 25 games last year for, you know, a positive drug test.
Fair.
To me, that's kind of the thing. I'm always going to be not on Team Collins for that. I'm not sure I'm ever going to get over that, Michael. I'm still hung up on his lack of accountability because it threw away their entire season. And I wonder, like, and there's been discussion about trade interest there with Collins, and he turned down reportedly a $90 million extension before the season. He obviously views himself as, you know, more like a max level player. Does this really feel like a long term home for him? If I'm him, I'm looking around and saying, well, they just paid Gallinari all this money. We've got all these other offensive weapons. They bring in Capella. They draft a center. There's a lot of chairs kind of moving around the John Collins chair. You know, it almost seems like they're kind of preparing themselves for maybe him not being there long term. And if that's the case, it kind of feels out of turn for him to just come and be the one raising these issues so early in a season that did get off to a really promising start. You know what I mean? It's like, not that Atlanta can win without John Collins, no problem, but he's not exactly a central force of what they're trying to do. I mean, maybe he was viewing himself in that light a few years ago when he was one of the first people from this current group to arrive on that roster. But I think times have changed a little bit. Obviously, Trey has established himself as a different type of player than John Collins has. I almost wonder, is this a case where John Collins needs to know his role, Michael?
I like John Collins' game. I want to push back a little bit on your statement that maybe he's not, you know, a central part of their plan going forward, because I don't think if you're a front office, you make a $90 million offer unless you feel really positively about a player. And so it's more on the player's side for rejecting that offer and thinking that, you know, betting on himself and thinking that he's worth more. And, you know, the Gallo thing is obviously they play the same position, and, you know, playing them both at the same time, your defense is probably not going to be up to snuff. But that deal is not you know, for the next seven seasons, and Gallo's an old guy. So
I'm just saying, if I was Collins, I'd be paranoid. They bring in two centers since last March, right? So if I was trying to play any minutes at center, that got weird, you know. And you're going to assume that if they're drafting a guy with the sixth pick in the draft, he's going to be a long-term investment there. And then they spend basically, you know, not the biggest money that they put out there this summer, but some of the biggest money they put out there at a guy at your exact same position who's more established than you. And, you know, it's, that's pretty awkward, you know?
No, it's not great. I'm sure he probably wanted them to invest at different positions. That would make a lot of sense just for someone who's averaging, you know, fewer minutes this season than he did despite all those injuries. But like, I don't know. I just think like offensively, he's just a really good fit with Trey, and I wish they could get it together and get on the same page, because he's a pogo stick. He's a walking double-double. He's one of the better rim runners that Trey could possibly be matched up with. He's someone who can pop out to the three-point line. He was one of the most efficient pick-and-pop shooters in the league last season. Those three-point numbers aren't quite what they were right now, but you would imagine that they'll go up a little bit as the season progresses, hopefully for him. And yeah, I like, you know, when I first saw that report from The Athletic, I did think that, you know, this is not a really positive step in the right direction if you are John Collins and you want to spend the rest of your career in Atlanta for sure. But at the same time, the fact that he felt emboldened enough to speak out also says something about how he views his own stature in that organization. Because like that takes a lot of confidence to speak out against someone who's an obvious franchise player and centerpiece and who the Hawks are trying to build around. So it's a pretty nuanced, like layered dilemma here for him and for the organization. And
well, let me
really
put it right to you
to see how it plays out.
Let me put it right to you. Would you want to play with Trae Young? Because, you know, it either you're spinning it as it takes a level of confidence. It could also just take a level of impatience, which is where you started.
Sure.
And I think that's very possible too. Like Trae Young would be kind of an aggravating guy to play with. I mean, he's going to be a high variance player. On some nights he's going to look incredible. And to answer the emailer's original question, I think the Hawks are, you know, not as good as they looked in the first four games, probably not as bad as they looked the last four games. The truth is going to be somewhere in the middle. We're still waiting to see exactly where their baseline falls, but when you're relying so heavily on one guy and he's relying so heavily on three-point shots and sometimes low percentage three-point shots, there's going to be big swings in terms of how you look on a night-to-night basis. And the injuries that you mentioned earlier, Michael, you know, that just makes things even more difficult. So, you know, to me, I saw them right in the middle of that, you know, play-in type pack. And I think that they're going to be right on track for that. And they're going to be fun and frisky on some nights. They're going to scare teams on some nights. And then they're just going to get run off the court on other nights. And that happens too. And that's difficult to manage, you know, from a night-to-night basis, especially if you're in a contract year for a guy like Collins. But if you were in his spot, would you want to play with Trey? You know, I think that I've asked you this question about guys like James Harden or Kawhi Leonard before. You know, if we talk about Steph, I think it's an automatic yes. Everybody wants to play with Steph. Do you want to play with Trey, though?
Do you want to play with Steph is just so, it's just like such an unfair comparison. We got to stop doing that. Because the answer is obviously yes.
Well, yeah, there's a spectrum, though. I mean, there's like, you know, some guys, there's more compromises involved, right? With Harden, it depends on what kind of player you are. You might say absolutely yes if you're a PJ Tucker or for a few years there, Austin Rivers. And then, you know, if you're a guy who wants to dribble the basketball or do almost anything else, you know, you might talk yourself into it. And then you might demand a trade 1 year later, like a Russell Westbrook, right? So there's a range here on these players. I would absolutely want to play with Luka, even though he's very ball dominant. But with Trey, I have more hesitation. How about you?
Like, if I'm playing with a guy who's shooting 28% from the three-point line, and, you know, I have no idea when the ball is going up and he's continuously freelancing and improvising in ways that are just destructive to our team and like my own personal like energy and the fact that like I want numbers because I am trying to get paid too, then I would be pretty upset. I just don't understand why sometimes like these issues can't get squashed, like simply, like why Trae Young is so reportedly having such a difficult time accepting criticism that is like blatant and fair, in my opinion. And reportedly there were others in the room who agreed with John Collins' assessment of the situation. So what is it because he was an all-star starter and you can't tell him anything? I don't know what it is. I don't want to assume, but like, you look at the talent and it's just, it bursts like off the screen. He's a ridiculous basketball player. He's so good. He does set up his teammates for open looks because he draws so much attention, and he can be that type of Steph Curry player if he were to embrace some of the more selfless natures of the game. But right now, I don't think I would be too pumped about being his teammate. No.
Yeah, he's going to have to make some adjustments, or someone's going to have to kind of get through to him. The tricky part as well is that not only are you describing some of the offensive limitations, but I think that his teammates also probably feel like he's the weakest link defensively, and they're having to cover up for him regularly. And that would also be a source of tension too. Like, if I had to go out there and set screens for him and get looked off, and he's jacking a 30-footer, and on the other end, I'm constantly coming across to, you know, help on his guy because he's going straight to the basket, That would rub me the wrong way. So it's a tricky thing, but that's part of being a leader. I think Trey's got kind of a two-guard mentality rather than a point-guard mentality, and I don't know if he can adjust that as he goes through, but it is pretty fascinating to watch unfold from just his career development arc, because like you said, the talent is off the charts, but it's more than just, you know, going out there and hosting a Ball is Life mixtape, right? Like, NBA is a different, more complicated game, and he's going to have to learn that. I understand why he would be sensitive to criticism, though. I mean, his team sucked the last couple of years. There wasn't a lot of talent. He was the only guy. He had to do everything, and he was a pretty good trooper through all of it. So, you know, I think that makes him naturally defensive when people are coming back around, and that's part of the adjustment when you get to play with better players, right? Obviously, he wants them to go out there and invest in the roster to give him some tools to work with. Well, you're going to have to be responsible now as the lead ball handler for establishing positive and productive two-way relationships with those guys, right? So everybody benefits. And that's not an easy task, especially for a guy who's been asked to do it all the last couple of years. I want to close on this note, Michael. We got a very, very kind email from Adam. He writes, "Hey, Ben in the pod. Love the podcast. You guys have been in my ears for a while now when I exercise. I won't drag on about it, but I ran a marathon on December 19th without doing any specific training because two friends of mine asked me if I wanted to join. Although this sounds foolish, I do try and keep reasonably fit. About 30 kilometers in, we hit a bit of a wall, and I needed something to keep me going. One friend put his headphones in and played his pump-up playlist to keep him going. But me, all I needed was the dulcet tones of Ben and Michael to take my mind away from the pain in my legs. I can't express how much I needed Michael's advocacy for all of the Suns players for most improved player candidates, and how much better Doc Rivers is going to be for Joel Embiid this season." So, Michael, I mean, what a compliment. First of all, who just casually runs a marathon? I've never heard of that in my entire life. But congratulations to Adam for making it through. But, Michael, how does it feel to inspire you know, our listeners to athletic feats of greatness?
I mean, it feels terrific. Congratulations to Adam. I have no idea what is wrong with you in terms of listening to a podcast as you're trying to get up enough energy to complete a marathon, but I respect the hell out of it. Speaking as someone who really has endurance issues when it comes to running, and it doesn't matter what I'm listening to, although I literally could not even imagine listening to a podcast, but this is an incredible compliment, an incredible honor, and I'm glad that you appreciate my takes more than Ben's.
Yeah, you're right, Michael. It was kind of loss after loss after loss for me this week from the emailers. They're all taking team pod sides, killing me. I am very jealous of being able to run a marathon. I think I could really get into this, just the steadiness aspect, the testing aspect. I can't do it. I've got a bum knee, and I can't run long distances like you're describing. So I'm going to live vicariously through Adam's email. Very impressive work. Michael, I don't think that we should adopt your proposed slogan, though, of "What the hell is wrong with you?" as our podcast slogan. Not sure that's the right message that we're trying to send. And maybe it's, "Hey, everybody, welcome. Join the Open Floor Globe. Listen to us when you're doing dishes or, you know, running marathons or getting in your exercise routine or commuting, whatever it might be." Maybe something a little bit more positive, Michael. Come on now.
No, you're right. I apologize, Adam. I was just very surprised to hear that someone like who belongs to the same species as me could do this. But it is very, very impressive.
It's quite the flex, honestly. Casually running a marathon. Boy, I wish I could just drop that into an email. Maybe one day, Michael, we all have aspirations. All right, we're going to double back later this week. We're going to talk about Victor Oladipo and the Indiana Pacers' strong start. I know you wrote about this week for SI.com, Michael. We've got a number of other questions from people weighing in, but let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail@gmail.com. You guys can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you get there, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Now, Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael Villas and Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. All right, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.